accession number 28500, reel 2.
And the next day was the start of training, when you were into a platoon proper and you knew exactly where you were in the barracks.
Mm-hmm. And can you describe the kit that they gave you on that first day for us?
Oh yeah, well, clothing, khaki dress, which was very rough and poor at that time in the beginning of the war, and the underclothes, braces, the jacket, the Balmoral, and the boots, gaiters, all same issue from the start. You know, everybody was kitted out exactly the same, and I must say it was well done, because the uniform fitted and the clothing fitted, so they knew what they were doing. There was very few complaints, but they got kitted out, and then all the other things which came on one after the other, and within 2 days after the injections and so forth, we were able to carry out proper training, which was quite hard. You know, you had a full day of drill, and on the ranges, shooting, firing, and all the different things you had to do, map reading, all sorts of things. But it was worked out so well that you had just a certain time here and there at the different training. And it helped me in a way too, because I was able then, I had quite a good memory, and I was able to remember what I had been taught, you know, before, so I could teach others. And it worked out, yeah.
And so when were you put into the barracks? When did you get into the barracks, you know, for, like, sleeping quarters?
Oh, yes, well, the rooms were on the edge of the square, and our room was a top room at the far end, and that was our home for the next month or so when we were training. And then, as we got up and got promotion and so forth, we changed into different areas where we were, where we trained then, and different rooms as you went on. Mm-hmm. But in the beginning, it was on the main square, and of course, most of our day was on the square drilling. Drilling was the main thing to start off with. It was quite funny too, yeah.
And your room, did it have a name or anything? Can you remember?
No, just room 21, or, you know, the dollar number. And just the beds all lined up on both sides. And there was a fireplace and a big coal bunker for the coal and to keep it warm. It was quite comfortable. And each bed had also a chest of drawers where you kept all your clothing and everything else too. So It was good, and the blankets, sheets, everything. We were well looked after. It was good. I enjoyed it.
And how many men would have shared the room?
Well, in my case, it was about 21 altogether in the room. They normally held about 20, usually. Yeah, that type of room. But then, as you went on, you got different types where you got more. There was more space and more people in it. And they like listen huts and places like that, away from the barrack rooms, the proper barrack rooms. But the barrack rooms were good. Yeah, it's a good start. Mm-hmm. It was.
Did you mind sharing your room with so many other men?
Oh no. The only problem you had was the first thing in the morning at the valley, you know, being able to shave, and it might be just 2 mirrors, you see, and of course, what you had to do was. What I had to do was get up early before the valley, 10 minutes before the valley, and get down so I could get a mirror to shave and to wash before the rest all came clumbering in, and you couldn't get near the basins to wash or anything because so many. But that was the only hazard you had, and the way out of it was simply to get there earlier in the morning and before the rush started. But that was the only hazard we had, actually, was the morning.
So what time would you have had to get up in the morning to get your shave?
5 minutes to 6 in the morning. And you could go to the cookhouse and get a mug of cocoa or tea And what they did was the bread that was left over, and the heels and that, was all toasted, and you could get a piece of the toast and that mug in the morning. And you needed it too, because you immediately went to PT in the morning. After six, from 6 to 6:30 was PT, then breakfast, and then parades, 8 o'clock, and training the whole rest of the day. It was a set program. It wasn't difficult to follow. It just took a day or two to get settled in and to know what you were going to do and how you had to do it. It was good fun.
And can you describe to us the drill that you had to do in the army? Can you describe that, please?
The drill. The
drill.
Oh, yes, well, the first drill, of course, was marching. Being able to march in step and march together. And you did get a few chaps who weren't able to march. You know, they couldn't coordinate limbs, arms with legs. But it gradually sorted. But where you found the one or two who were rather slow to pick it up, you took them to a side square and you taught them there away from the main squad. Once they were able to cotton on to what was required, then they were put back into the squad again. That's how we did it. Now, I often got jobs like that to do, to train the ones that were difficult. So sort them out and then get them back into the squad again. And by the end of the day, within 3 weeks, you had a team of characters there, all drilling professionally, you know, keeping step and keeping in line and so forth. Was good. It was good. Oh, yes.
And what else did you do the rest of the day? Can you describe to us what you did on a normal day?
The normal day was that first reveille, 5 minutes to 6, your cup of tea, quick cup of tea, and then drill, a PT from 6 to 6:30, and then breakfast, and on parade at 8 o'clock on the square. And it was always a question of lining up onto markers, so that all the platoons, you might be five or six platoons, all 30, 180, 200, 250 men, all lining up at the same time. And the markers was quite fun, because you were pulled out to do a marker, and that was, you had to line up in a line, and walk out the whole length of the square, dropping off each one as you went, and then the squads behind all lined up and they joined the right marker, so therefore you got your platoons all the way up. And you might have 7 or 8 platoons all lined up one after the other, and that was good fun. And then the drilling started, you know. And it was quite a bit of noise, and you had to pay attention to what the sergeant was saying and so forth. It was good. But it was good fun.
And could you generally hear him okay?
Oh, yes. Well, the voices, you know, they got so strong that you could hear them. And then you could hear the different pitch of the different voices too. And your own one, your own sergeant, you know, you could pick him up quicker than the rest probably. But you were just responsible to him for the drilling. So, and then... depended some days on the square, it might be not so many people on it, so therefore you could move out and train further away and you get more room and much easier to hear what was being said and all the different drills and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and what did you do after that? You know, after the drill time, what would you have done then?
Well, there would have been the section leading work, you know, patrols. Learning about patrols and following up patrol, what a patrol did and so forth, and how to keep in line, how to watch what was going on. Then you had not only the drills and the section training, you had map reading, you had first aid, you had all different things to do throughout the day.
And can you describe to us a patrol, please? What would you have done in a patrol?
Well, that was done on the outside the barracks, on the golf courses and the other places, the rough ground. That was done there, where you would teach them to, or be taught to move in a patrol, move through the day, move at night, and the passing of messages, and that was quite a funny one, because what you did was you lined up your platoon, with maybe spaced out maybe 3 or 4 feet between them, and you gave the one end a message, and he had to pass it on down the line. And of course, the message at the end bore no relation to what it started. So that was why you were taught to be able to give a proper message and be able to see if it was carried on and not changed. That was quite fun at times, yes.
Was that a verbal message?
Verbal message, so you can imagine where you got 20 chaps lined up, and by the time it got down the whole lot, it bore no relation to what was started at this end. But that was good fun, yeah.
And were the golf courses in Aberdeen being used for that type of thing?
Oh, yes. And then all our night training was done in the courses, on the golf courses too, yes. All the night training. Mm-hmm. That was all done there. Mm-hmm.
Okay. What else would you have done in a normal day? You know, just whilst you're training. This is at the very start of your training. What else would you have done?
Well, afterwards, of course, the evening was the spit and polish and getting ready for next day. Boots had to be polished, and your trousers and jacket not ironed and pressed, ready for next day. You look out your equipment and see it was right and sorted. So you had quite a lot of things to do to be ready for the next day. But that had to be done in the evening, in your own time. That was done in your own time.
And did someone help you and guide you about how best to press your clothes or to clean your boots?
Oh, yes. The junior NCOs, like the lance corporals and the corporals, they showed you what to do, told you what to do. And it didn't take much. It just showed you this is the best way to do it and how to do it, and that was it. And you had to do it yourself then. But, well, you were all taught how to do that, because a lot of people had never ironed their own clothes before, so it was something new for them, yeah.
And were there enough irons and iron boards, or?
Ah, well, there was always a shortage of that, so it was a question of, especially in the evening, when one lot was finished, and you went to the next lot, and they got the board, and you just let them know, I'm finished, and somebody else would come, and it was a continuous ironing process during the evening, and pressing, but they all got through it. Oh, yes, we got it done, yeah.
Okay, now, this is 1940, so it was before steam irons. Mm-hmm. I take it. So how did you press? You know, how did you manage to press your clothes?
Well, in the evening, you were in your barrack room or what, and it was laid down where the iron would be. Maybe there might be 2 or 3 irons in the hut, and you just took your chance to go there, iron your clothes, and finished, and somebody else would come and take it on. But it was a continuous stream all the time, waiting to get press the clothing.
I think what I was trying to say was, it would have just been a normal hot iron.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just a normal iron, yes.
Okay, and what about your boots? Can you describe them?
Oh, my boots, well, that had to be spit and polish, of course, with the blacking and the polishing and so forth. And the... That had to be done in the evening also too. Yeah.
Did that take a long time?
Oh, it took a while. The evenings always passed pretty quickly, you know, and then there would be a feeling of maybe a little bit of tiredness creeping in, so you're ready to get to bed before lights out and they'd be ready for the valley next morning.
What time was lights out?
10 o'clock. 10 o'clock. Yes. Mm-hmm.
And how about food whilst you were training?
Food? Well, I found food very good. I mean, I know there's a lot of complaints from different people now, but I found that the food was very good. Breakfast was good, and you had a choice. You could have bacon, you could probably have egg, you could porridge or cornflakes, and tea. Tea was the normal thing. There were very few coffees or that. Tea was the main thing. And then lunch, soup. There would be probably 2 days of meat during the week. But it was quite adequate, and plenty of bread, and the same at tea time at night, the same again, and of course you also had the nafe. So in your spare time you could go and you get a cup of tea, or you could get a meal if you wanted it, paid for it, and that was that. But on the whole, the feeding was good. It's adequate. Yeah.
And did you ever use the nafe? Did you ever go to the nafe?
Sometimes I went. Not often, but if I had a spare moment and they wanted a cup of tea or that, I would go and do that, yes. Mm-hmm. And of course, our salaries were very, very poor, and you couldn't afford to lunch out too much. So you didn't go too often for a meal, you know. Cup of tea, yes, I'd get a cup of tea and an after, it was all right. Didn't cost very much. But to get a meal of that, it could be quite expensive.
Mm-hmm. Can you remember how much it was?
Oh, well, when I went in, it was 7 shillings per week. That was a shilling a day, roughly. And you couldn't get very much for that. But that was why I think it egged people on to get promotion. Because as you went up the ladder, the lance corporal to sergeant, your money increased considerably. And it made people, pay more attention and to know that if you wanted more money, you had to work for it. You had to get promotion. And that was good, yeah.
Okay. So to have a meal out in the nafe, would that have been quite expensive?
Oh, yeah, well, yes, it would have been. You'd probably have to pay maybe 1 and 6 pence, shilling. And if it was a big meal, maybe 2 shillings, you know. But then it went away with a lot of the money, that was the thing, yes. You know. And then gradually the pay went up, and we got 14 shillings. We doubled 14 shillings a week, and that was much better, yeah.
And why did they double the wages?
I think probably they saw that they were causing a hazard, you know, in the ranks with so little money and so unable to get a meal if you wanted a meal of that. And so the proper pay went up to 14 shillings, which was good then. That was quite good, that. But it wasn't a lot of money, no.
And how did these wages compare with the wages that you had been getting on the estate? How did it compare?
Oh, well, the wages then, of course, were very light too. If I remember rightly, at Huntly Lodge, when I went to Huntly Lodge, I got 30 shillings a week, which of course was quite good at that time, 30 shillings, and it increased as you went on. After a year, it went up to £2 something. But even so, it wasn't much money, and then you had to pay for your lodgings. So by the time you paid for your lodgings and the meals that you got, you know, you weren't left with very much at all, no. But to manage.
Okay. So the 7 shillings a week, did that include your accommodation and your food as well?
That's right. You see, your food was free, your clothing was free, and your accommodation was free. But that was all you had to get your cup of tea or to get a meal if you wanted a meal of that extra. Then that was all you had to. So it made you pay quite a bit of attention to your money, what money you had. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so why did you decide to join the Gordons if you'd maybe been getting better money before it? Why?
Well, I suppose in a way that my old headmaster was maybe to blame for that, you know, because he said he always warned me that war was coming and to be ready, you know, and not to be caught unawares, you see. So I took it to heart. I thought, well, I'm not the only one that's joining. There's hundreds and thousands of people joining, so therefore it's only but right that I should do my little bit too. That's how I felt about it.
Okay. And you also mentioned in your training that you had some rifle training as well from the Gordons. Can you describe that for us?
Which training?
A rifle training.
Oh, the rifle training. Oh, yeah, well, that was the handling of the rifle. the cleaning of the rifle, and then taught how to hold it properly and how to fire. And then you went on the ranges, you know, quite often to the ranges, and fired on the ranges, and you were taught to become a good shot. And that was a big help too. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that was still in your basic training?
I was just basic training, yes.
Mm-hmm. And can you remember the type of rifle that you used?
Oh yes, just the one rifle. That was the Lee Enfield 303. Yes. And excellent rifle.
And can you describe how you cleaned it?
Oh yeah, well, the cleaning was the cleaning of the barrel with the rod, pushing through and keeping it clean, looking up into the light and seeing if the barrel was clean, and then light oil all over the rifle, butt and everything. And the same with the mechanism, making sure that was right too. And the beauty of the Lee Enfield 303 was that it could fire in all sorts of conditions, mud, rain, sand, dirt, also it could still fire, whereas lots of other rifles couldn't fail unless they were in a clean environment, you know. So it was good, very dependable.
And where about did they start training you with the rifle?
Well, I was taught first on the farm, of course, and then taught again with much better training on the estate when I went to Lady Davidson, and that gave me a good insight into how to clean, how to hold, how to fire properly when I went into the army. So I didn't require much training at all because I already knew what to do. So it's just a question of shooting properly and getting good target marks when you fire.
Okay, and where about did they do that? Was that in the barracks? Was that?
There was a 30-yard range in the barracks which was used often. And then we went to the Black Dog ranges where we fired at 100 yards, 200 yards, up to 400 yards with the rifle. But you were competent by that time, you see. You were able to shoot properly by that time. But in the beginning, it was a 30-yard range on the at the barracks where you did all your first shooting.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And did you manage that okay?
Oh, I no problems. Oh, yes. Oh, no, I had no difficulty with that, no. But the one good thing about the army, too, you know, they were very considerate in many ways. For example, when I went to the Black Dog ranges, as I mentioned already, you always got a few that couldn't fire, you know. They closed their eyes when they, you know, and squeezed it, and there were no near the target and that. And because I was reckoned to be a good shot, I used to get the ones that were poor shooters, and I had to take them onto another range and they teach each one individually how to hold, how to aim properly, and how to fire, until I got them able to fire and hit their target. And that was quite good because you saw the progress, how they couldn't fire to begin with, but by the time you finished with them, they were able to fire. And it gave them a lot of confidence too, you know. It was good.
Can you describe to us how you would hold and aim a rifle, please?
Oh yes, well, the holding of the rifle properly, balanced in your left hand and your trigger finger here, and how to hold it with the butt into the shoulder and hold it and look through the sight at your target, and then squeeze your trigger and the shot goes off. But it was the same procedure every time. No, there was no change in that. It was a question of holding it properly, firmly, and aiming properly and firing. So it all, within a 2 or 3 weeks, you know, they could all fire pretty reasonably. Oh, yes.
And by doing that, did you ever get any pain or anything to the shoulder when you pulled the trigger?
Not with the 303, no, you didn't. But unless you were not holding it properly, you know. But there was a boy's anti-tank rifle came out a year or so later, and it had a tremendous recoil, and if you weren't holding it properly, you really got a damaged shoulder, you did. But not with the 303, not with the Lee Enfield, no. It's a question of just holding it properly, firmly, and aiming properly, and there's no fear.
Okay. And did you enjoy going out to the Black Dog?
Oh yes, that was always a whole day. You know, away for a whole day, and firing at different ranges, 100 yards, 200 yards, and just to show what the rifle could do, some of us who were good shots would show the markers at 400 yards, so that it gave everybody confidence that the rifle they had was good. It was up to them to hold it properly and to fire properly. So that was always good fun. And then you sometimes used to get a lottery in it, you know, and a few shillings here and there for the best shots. And sometimes I took part in it, and sometimes I didn't. But it was all to speed up the fact that you had a good rifle, and by holding it properly and firing properly, you had a really good defensive weapon. And it proved itself time and time again. It did.
Okay. And whilst you were in this basic training, were you allowed out in your free time? Were you allowed out of the barracks?
Not for the first, it was 3 weeks, we weren't allowed out. And after that, when you've been about a month in, you were allowed out on certain days. But you'd always be back in the barracks by a certain time. And of course, those who didn't come back in time, they penalised themselves for getting out again, you see. So it was a process of paying attention to discipline and going out and coming back to proper time.
Part three, and I'm still with Mr. McHardy. We spoke about your service up at Huntley Lodge Estate, and about how you couldn't get into the TAs, but yet you thought there was a war approaching. Do you think in yourself now that you could feel there was a war coming on? You know, do you think yourself that war was going to start?
Oh, yes. The reason for that was not only what I thought myself, but the headmaster telling me in 1936 a war was coming, which I knew personally he wouldn't tell me that unless it was positive. And then at Huntley Lodge, the two sons, one in the former Gordons and the one in the Royal Engineers, and he says, "Oh, the war's coming." And he was preparing himself for war, you know, when that was in 38, 39. And so I just thought, well, it's quite obvious that something's going wrong. And then you could read between the lines and the different news and that something wasn't right. And so I thought, well, there's no point in waiting. If something happens, the sooner you get started and do something, the better. So, but I'm glad I did.
And were these two sons still in the forces?
No. The one who was in the 6th Battalion in the First World War, he's a famous surgeon in Edinburgh, a very well-known surgeon. But the one who was in the Royal Engineers, he was still serving. He was still serving.
And when you said that in the news, was there the radio broadcasts and the newspapers? Was there indications there, do you think, that war was about to start?
Yes. There was lots of different little things that were coming to light. And the one thing that always sticks in my mind was the Daily Express, 1938. And they had a caption saying, you know, that they were quite convinced that Germany was rearming, and that they had noticed or found out from some source that there was huge buildings being built, and they were quite certain that that was covering aircraft and airfields and so forth. And then the next thing was the chief of the staff. He went out to Germany in 1938 on an invitation from the German army to attend their annual exhibitions and when he went out and he saw what they were producing.